702 and Cape Talk.
Family Matters.
21 minutes after 11 o'clock, and as promised, from now until the end of the show, we have Stephanie Beauvais back with us, clinical psychologist who practices at the Sahiti School in Johannesburg, and a very important topic we're looking at today. If you want to call in, we're going to be talking about self-harming. This is a safe space. We're going to try and do as much as we can to give you advice, to help you out. Well, she will mostly do that as the expert, and we also need to understand with some compassion what is it that drives many people, for example, to cut themselves. So when we're talking about self-harm, there are different kinds of self-harm. Obviously, the worst, arguably, is dying by suicide, that it can be a form of self-harm. But we're talking about other kinds of self-harm we don't talk about in society. I certainly have never spoken about it on radio, such as, for example, someone who may be cutting themselves. 011-883-0702, give us a call. Maybe you've experienced this, maybe you've been doing this to yourself, thinking about it, or you have a loved one, a colleague, a friend who's been going through this, and you're not quite sure how to deal with this, what it means, where it comes from, what kind of conversations to open up, or what kind of help to try and persuade them gently to seek. If you're in Cape Town, 021-446-0567. Stephanie, it's wonderful having you back on the show. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks always for having me, Eusebius, and a very good morning to you and your studio and to all of the listeners out there as well.
Where do we even begin with this? I suppose one curiosity I have is whether the research tells us how prevalent in the population self-harm actually is, and also different demographics, different parts of the city, the country. Is this something that happens to anyone potentially? What do we know about self-harm?
Well, I think if we're talking about prevalence, there are a few interesting concepts to consider and to think about. Naturally, I think research is always a little bit different to experience, and all clinicians and practitioners deal with what comes into their office differently. But I guess if I draw from my own experience, you know, I think the stats when researching, when looking at how to assist our clients, don't always paint a picture of what is happening in reality. So although we have present stats, and when I say present, I don't think that research is done as often as it should be. So the stats that I came across when I was researching for this topic are from a National Youth Behavior Risk Survey conducted in 2008. Now, technically, that research should be conducted on a yearly basis, but the stats available to me were those in 2008. So one would imagine that it's far more of a prolific pandemic at the moment. And the stats I came across were ranging from as little as 13%, which is actually quite high, to 45% of the population. Now, I think because of the nature of the difficulties, a lot of it goes underreported. I also think that because the behavior is often parasuicidal, in other words, it is not meant to cause grievous bodily harm that would come to the offices of a general practitioner or a hospital, we don't have appropriate stats available to us at the moment. If we're thinking about demographics, if I look at the kind of the gender split or divide, I think a lot of the adolescents that I see in my practice who do report having self-harmed are predominantly females. But then again, I think that although society is changing, practitioners do tend to have more females in their practice than males. Males are less likely to report feeling anxious or depressed, and so they don't necessarily come to our attention. But what the stats show is that as adolescents go into their early adult years, there is actually an equal balance between males and females who are actually self-harming. What changes, though, is the type of self-harm. So where your females are more likely to cut and scratch and carve, your males are more likely to engage in things like self-punching or punching other objects, far more aggressive acts.
Do we understand what the aim is? Because oftentimes when we try and guess, and when we are unempathetic in particular, we might say, oh, well, Stephanie's just looking for bloody attention, man. She really wanted to harm herself, probably she would have killed herself. Just ignore her. She doesn't really want to die. And it strikes me that not only is that unhelpful, but there must be all sorts of interesting layers to why someone might be deliberately inflicting physical harm on themselves. And it's not even obvious to me that the first aim may be to look for attention or to be noticed? What goes on? Do we understand?
Look, I think one of the most important things to consider when a client enters your office, and this is not just for psychologists, but as first ports of calls, that may be a teacher, a parent, a pastor, a counselor of some kind, is to make sure that you're non-judgmental in your responses. I think we have a range of responses to self-harm, one of which I think can be sort of extreme repulsion, depending on how extreme the self-harm is. And then obviously on the other extreme, the empathy that one feels when you consider how unimaginable the pain that the other person is going through. So, you know, I think it's really important to always consider that whatever is reaching your desk, whatever is reaching your ear as the person who's listening on to these difficulties, is to always respond with the seriousness that it requires. You know, for me, having experienced all of this in my practice, at face value, it's never a manipulation. It's never attention-seeking behavior, very similar to suicidality. It's so important to differentiate self-harm from suicidality. In respect to suicidality, the person does not wish to live anymore, as opposed to someone who self-harms. So the reports have come from clients that they self-harm in order to paradoxically live, to stay alive, to prevent suicide. I think the main feedback or reports that we get is that self-harm comes from a place of being able to cope with unimaginable, very overwhelming, intense feelings that would otherwise not be able to be coped with on a far more abstract or mindful level.
Can we try and go into that paradox? So the person who self-harms wishes to live, but they obviously have enormous challenges that are causing all sorts of things at the level of mental well-being that are not quite, you know, where it should be.
Mm.
If I were to self-harm, let's say cut myself anywhere in my, I don't know, on my arm or whatever the case might be, on my legs, in that moment, how does the self-harm, in the logic of the person self-harming, help them paradoxically to feel more alive and to feel like they have a bit more reason to stay on this earth rather than actually becoming suicidal, for example?
Well, I think at the very simplistic level of responding to your query, your concern is essentially a lot of self-injurers report not being able to feel.
Okay.
Essentially from the basis of not being able to name what they're feeling, to being able to regulate their emotions and work through them as someone who has a more sophisticated repertoire of being able to do that would do. So essentially what the reports are coming through to us is that they want to enliven what feels emotionally deadened. From another perspective, you know, a biological perspective, when we injure ourselves, there's quite a strange process that happens where there's a release of endorphins. So what happens is that the brain becomes almost accustomed to the relief of tension that happens with the cutting.
Okay.
And so it craves that and longs for that the next time the tension builds. Mm. So it's a bit of a conditioning effect.
I'm thinking of a very weird analogy here, Stephanie. You know, like when your heart has stopped and doctors just give you a bolt of electricity through it in the hope of just livening it up quite literally again, and hopefully resuscitating you. There's a similar kind of, and I really love this paradox. It's new to me. I'm sure it'll be new to many other people, that paradoxically it is an attempt to feel.
Right.
And to deal with the numbness.
And I think because self-injurers struggle with numbness, with not being able to connect with what they're feeling or regulate it,
or confront
the intolerable anxiety it brings, they cut in order to have that surge of emotion.
Give us a call. Have you self-harmed, self-injured? Do you understand why you were doing it? How were you able to cope? Are you struggling at the moment? Perhaps this is something you're secretly doing, but you've never had the space to be able to speak about it. Give us a call on 011-883-0702 in Joburg, in Cape Town, on 021-446-0567. Or perhaps you know that someone else is going through this, who's a loved one, a child perhaps that you entrusted into your care, a colleague, and you're not quite sure how to open up this conversation. We're talking about self-harm. Cutting is a typical example of that. And if you don't want to be in dialogue with me or Stephanie, but you'd like to share your story, you're also welcome to leave us a voice note, 072-702-1702.
702 and Cape Talk.
Family Matters.
27 minutes before noon, we're talking about self-harm such as cutting. And if you'd like to be in conversation with Stephanie, 011-883-0702 is the number. You can dial us right now. It's a safe space. Ask any question and try and get some help, or maybe help for someone else that you know of who's going through what we've just been describing. 021-446-0567. So when people are inflicting injuries on themselves, I'm very curious, do we know whether they actually experience the sensation of pain? Because, I mean, it's bloody painful just to have someone pinching you.
Mm. I've often wondered. The initial feeling is pain, and then that's quickly replaced by euphoria. So a lot of clients will report feeling that initial euphoric release, almost adrenal release, as though a drug addict who is experiencing a high. It's the same sort of high, essentially. Mm. So I think the pain is quite short-lived. And unfortunately, what follows then is the whole healing and repair process, which is not just physical, but also then psychological. The fact that you've inflicted physical pain onto yourself, and the shame and the guilt that induces that needs working through, brings you back to your initial complications as to why you cut in the first place.
How might I know whether or not someone is self-harming around me? I mean, if it's somewhere overt, like, for example, on your wrist, that's one thing. Mm. But presumably someone can inflict an injury on their body almost literally quite anywhere. I mean, you know, it could be in your legs, whatever the case might be, on your stomach, quite frankly, anywhere. How might we be empowered to be vigilant in terms of someone that may be at risk or already self-injuring?
Mm, look, it's extremely difficult because of the guilt and the shame associated with it. It's usually quite a hidden behavior. Again, also, we need to differentiate between the fact that self-harm is not necessarily a diagnostic clinical condition. It's a behavior, not an illness. And so unless the person has recognizable or diagnostic features of some other kind of syndrome, like an autism or a depression or an anxiety, with self-harm could be prevalent, a prevalent part of that condition, then it may remain unknown and unseen. But essentially, something to look out for is that the person may dress strangely for the type of weather that we're having. So in other words, they may wear long sleeves or pants when there's warm weather. They may have very frequent and eloquent creative explanations for why they've got these unexplained injuries, you know, often bruises and cuts to their bodies. Usually the cutting happens in an area where you can conceal it or hide it from the public, or from moms and dads, or from your spouse or partner. One of the most common places at the moment that adolescents particularly are starting to cut is in the groin area, which is naturally often covered.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is very difficult to recognize, but important to kind of explore further if you start to see these cuts and bruises or regular injuries and the person has strange explanations for why that's happening.
That makes sense, yeah. Steve, good morning. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Steven.
Hi there, Steve.
Hi, can you hear me?
We can hear you. Thanks for calling in. And go right ahead. Stephanie's here and we're both listening to you.
Hi, Stephanie. I'm a 41-year-old dad that's been divorced twice. A 41-year-old dad that had a really tough childhood as a kid, and emotionally I've never been able to control that. And the only way I've ever been able to get through it is to actually inflict harm on myself. And the strange thing about doing that is that, yes, it releases endorphins, but it also kind of... it allows you to take that frustration on yourself because you tend to blame yourself for everything that's happened.
Mm.
You know, which is a tough thing. But what do you do? I mean, you're sitting in traffic and all of a sudden you have this rush of thoughts going through your brain and you feel like you can have a complete breakdown, but you can't. And when you go back home, you have a house full of kids. So you can't. So you've got to find some way of taking this out on yourself. And it's a difficult thing to explain, but recently I've gone completely in another direction. I can't cut myself anymore because my kids are very observant. The older they get, the more observant they are.
Mm.
So now I've turned to tattoos. So if once a month I'll find a tattoo, put it in a place where I know it's going to hurt for 2.5 hours, and I go and sit through it. And that's what I do.
Steve, thanks for your sharing. I know it takes quite a lot of courage to share how extremely difficult life circumstances can be, and it's admirable that you've been able to do that. At some point, I think your children would also benefit from being able to hear that deep experience that you've had, and how you've found ways to cope with it. I will challenge you, though, to say that although one finds the easiest ways to try and cope with difficulties, there are alternative, healthy, adaptive measures to deal with that. I think, you know, when in practice, I see at least 50% of the clients that report self-injury to me are coming from very difficult backgrounds. So vulnerable backgrounds where child abuse is quite prolific, some form of either sexual or physical abuse. And so that tempers with a child's ability to develop capabilities of emotional regulation like others who may not experience that abuse at childhood. So I think one important thing to consider is that isn't your fault, and you need to be able to find ways to forgive yourself for the experience that you've had, and to kind of move on with an apology that you'll never get. Yeah. So rather than inflicting that harm onto yourself, which perpetuates historical abuse, to find ways instead of demonstrating love and care for yourself. Because I also believe that, sometimes difficulties also have generational transgressions.
Yeah.
So if your children are not able to see you modeling healthy, adaptive ways of regulating your emotions and finding other ways for tension relief, then they might just mirror the same types of processes which are not healthy or adaptive or socially acceptable. I want to touch on something that Steve said around tattooing. When I was saying earlier, self-harm is very different to suicide. Self-harm is also very different to tattooing and piercing. But there is a fine line. So when tattooing becomes something that is compulsive, ritualistic, and is not done as a form of expression or, artistic or creativity in some way, when it's done to experience the harm that it creates, then there is some psychology to that. There is something that needs to be explored. And the same thing with, with piercings. So we need to just be careful that whatever we're doing for the right reasons. And if it's something that is repeating the ills of the past, or it's something just purely to have us not contemplating what happened in the past, we eventually need to confront it, and to confront it in more adaptive, healthy ways. Because otherwise, I just think it's more avoidance than anything else.
Absolutely. Michael, good morning. Welcome.
Morning, Yuli. How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
Thanks. Sorry for asking that question. I also self-harm and that, and I cut and what, and the piercing and the tattooing, face, head, everywhere where it's painful, and go out and fight and carry on. But I'm at a point where, I don't know, it's not working no more, man.
And that's the thing with self-harm. Eventually, the pain subsides and we cut again, and the euphoria is released. And it's just a vicious cycle. There are huge amounts of assistance and support out there so that we can stop avoiding and start confronting.
Michael, when did you start self-harming?
Long time ago. It's been a while. I'm 52 almost, and that it's been a long while. I don't know, but it's more the pain and done the tattooing and all that nonsense and that, but it's every now and then I go out and I get involved on the streets and that, and I fight, but I don't eat back just to get beaten up, stabbed, bottles broken on me, whatever. I'm at a point where it's no good for me no more, and it's not, I'm not feeling euphoria or anything than that. It's just a case of I'm done with it, but I don't know how to break the cycle.
Have you ever had the opportunity, and if you had, I wonder whether you've taken it, have you ever had the opportunity to get counseling?
No, it's not something that I've ever thought of. I've had loved ones speak to me about it and things like that. But that thing of that you know, am I mental? Am I losing my mind? Is something wrong with me? Yeah. Sorry for the silly phone call.
No, it's not a sorry phone call, Michael. So I just want to ask you one more question, and I commend you. I want to honor your bravery. I know this is difficult. When you've had some loved ones speak to you about the possibility of, for example, therapy or counseling, what's your attitude towards that?
I'm open to it, now I am in my life, I'm open to it, because all the other things are not, I'm on a path to nowhere, which it's a nowhere road.
Michael, I want to say this to you. Yeah, I want to say this to you, not as an expert. Stephanie is the expert. Yeah. I want to speak to you just as one human to another human, right? I have been in wonderful weekly therapy now for a couple of months. I used to be in therapy on and off years ago. The last couple of months have been a beautiful experience, and I'm learning so much about the ways in which, especially childhood trauma, is carried into our adult lives in ways that you and I don't understand. We don't, and that's why the therapeutic context, if you have that privilege, because it's not available to everyone, sometimes expensive, it's not easily available within the state sector, but if loved ones are willing to help you out or you have access to it, please do not underestimate the incredible productive value of having access to that kind of opportunity to try and understand what lies at the base of your self-harm. You'll be amazed how each one of us have a shadow that sometimes haunts us into adulthood, and trauma that you experience as a 2-year-old, 5-year-old, 11-year-old, you may think you've dealt with it because you are performing at a high level even in your 40s and your 50s, but the body doesn't forget. There is blunt trauma, like when you were in a car accident or you went to the border being conscripted by Verwoerd's government, but then there's something else that you and I as non-experts don't understand, and I'm learning this very slowly now in my own life, which is developmental trauma, which is not the hectic textbook trauma, but the other kinds of traumas in our life. And it comes back to haunt us when we least expect it as functioning adults. Don't take for granted what a therapeutic context can do, because Stephanie is one of our most beautiful, empathetic experts in this slot. But he needs to go on a journey, doesn't he, Stephanie? Mm. And there's only so much we can do here.
He does. And, you know, I think the way in which Michael shared is actually quite poetic. And what he doesn't realize is that untapped potential in being able to express. So I think what he's done is he's converted that that need to express what he feels physically, emotionally, because it is so painful, to an expression physically. So thinking about that whole notion of the word made flesh, you know, not being able to express what you're feeling because it's so overwhelmingly painful, and it creates so much tension to releasing that physically. But what he doesn't realize is how poetic he can be, and how a therapeutic relationship can really be reparative and reconciliatory to the ills of the past, if he just gives it a chance. 100%. And he's welcome to give me a shout. The studio has my cell phone number. He can give me a shout and we can chat further and hopefully facilitate entry for him into a process.
Beautiful. Thank you for that. 14 minutes before noon, let's take a little bit of a break.
702 and Cape Talk. Family Matters.
Shirley, good morning to you and welcome to the show.
Yes, good morning. I have started scratching again. When I was a teenager, between 10 and 12, 13.
Okay, Shelley, the line's not great. I'm going to try and come back to you in a second. My apologies. I really want to honor your story and your sharing it as well. We'll see whether we can get you on a better line. Let's go to Cape Town. Sean, good morning to you and welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you for having me. Can you hear me?
We can now. Just turn your radio off if it is on in the background. We can hear you. Just a little bit of an echo. It should be sorted now. Go right ahead. Stephanie is listening. Talk to us.
All right. So I started self-harming around the age of 15 years old, because it first started with suicidality. I had a couple of failed attempts, and then I turned to self-harming. Mm-hmm. And then it's been years of diagnosis of this and that and the other, and now I'm 28 years old, and I am quite insightful. I can usually look at my emotions and tell myself that, hey, you're going through a rough patch at the moment. But what I want to know is about these support groups. Because you see, the problem is that when people who are able to deal with their problems better than somebody who has a mental illness or suffers from depression, who thinks of or even turns to self-harm, when they find out that, you know, you are doing this or you have these issues, they aren't very sympathetic, or they don't understand when you speak to them and tell them that, you know, you can't handle the emotions that you are feeling, even though the emotions are irrational. So that's why I am looking for a support group at the moment.
Hi, Sean. It's good to hear you on the line. Sean, I wish I could help you in Cape Town. It's a far prettier picture than Joburg. But I will definitely get the studio some research about the types of support groups that are available in Cape Town. I want to just respond to the complexity you bring up in speaking to individuals about what you're experiencing. At the moment, it seems like the jury's out as to whether self-injurers should be expressing their difficulties to others or not. A lot of people feel that sometimes expressing the difficulties actually perpetuates a bit of what we call a contagion effect. So if one person is deliberately self-harming, it has been related to others later deliberately self-harming. So a little bit of a sort of a fashionable kind of process. So one imagines that if one person shares their experience, it may influence, because we are a social peer type society, It may influence others who are maybe a little bit more impressionable. My personal and professional feeling, however, is that support groups are usually almost always supportive in nature. It definitely also has to do with the type of person who is facilitating those support groups. So I'm not saying that lay people cannot be facilitators of support groups, but I always find that there needs to be somebody who is, you know, slightly more professional in their understanding of the process and the dynamic in order to facilitate those groups to be reparative and not, you know, harmful or more harmful. So I think you're on the right track, Sean. I think social support groups, peer influencers, it's a good way to start addressing the type of difficulties, because I think one of the things that self-injurers report is that they cut in order to relieve a feeling of aloneness, of isolation, of estrangement, of marginalization. So it's always nice in the context of a support group to feel like I'm not the only one that's experiencing this. I'm not the only one that may resort to maladaptive ways of coping. And I may also find information or insights at these support groups of ways of coping that are far more adaptive, positive, healthy, and less injurious. So I'll definitely get you some numbers, and those can be passed on to your listeners.
Thanks, Stephanie. Shirley, good morning. I think we have you on a better line now. Go straight ahead.
Yes, sure. As I said, I'm 70 and I started scratching sores, making sores on my legs when I was about 10 to 12 years of age. And then I stopped doing it. And then about 9 months ago, I started doing it again. And I find it quite frustrating, because I think over my life, I've got an easier life now. I still work and have to do things, and my children are all grown up, but I live on my own. And I have suffered anxiety and depression a little bit, but it's just so strange that one should start up at this age of my life doing something like this. Luckily, I do talk to people about it. I have friends that I can express when I'm doing it. I have told my doctor. But it's just something that, and it's quite good to hear that other people do something crazy like this as well, even at my age now. And I think a lot of it for myself stems from maybe a sort of jealousy, or I had a mum that sort of idolized my brother, and even before she died, I used to get told by the nurses, but your mother loves your brother. Mm. And it's so stupid that you should talk have things like that can aggravate something and start you doing something all over again. That's not necessary, you know.
Shirley, I want to commend you for sharing your story at the sprightly age of 70, the lightness of spirit with which you're telling it. I am enormously happy for you that you are already speaking to your doctor about this and you have a bit of a support structure. There's so much that comes out of that for me. The immediate thing that I was thinking is, again, from the point of view of how complex our physical bodies are, you might think, but I've lived a full life. I've overcome mom doting on my brother. But the body sometimes has got its own non-linear timeline for dealing with this stuff.
And what I think is really important is that it's wonderful to be able to work through our difficulties, but that by no means that the ghosts of the nursery are no longer with us.
Yeah.
So we can work through the difficulties insofar as to ensure a productive future for ourselves, to ensure that it doesn't render us completely unable to have healthy, fulfilling relationships. But sometimes they do and they will reoccur and arise again. It does not mean that they're not fully worked through. It just means that there are reminders on what to invest in our future. I love that in Shirley's expression of what she is experiencing, that there is a suggestion that she's hopeful that it will change again.
Yes.
What I think is really important to remember as well is as life progresses, when we enter different developmental stages, it by no means means that we are not conducive or open to difficulties. You know, I think what Shirley's confronting at 70 is similar to what my mom is confronting with empty nest syndrome, where we think our problems have left because our children have their own lives. But then we go back to a feeling of being alone again. And I think that can render us quite, you know, open to difficulties and open to not necessarily being as eloquent in coping with our difficulties as we think we are. I think sometimes it's just reminders of what we've been through. And sometimes we do fall into the trap of acting in ways that are less healthy and less positive. But I think Shirley's well on her way to finding more adaptive ways of coping.
Absolutely. Thanks, Stephanie. Stunning conversation. Thank you for opening this one up, as it were.
Awesome. Thanks so much for having me.